Hello, welcome to My Camino, the podcast. I'm Dan Mullins, and it's great to think you're listening somewhere around the world. This is a podcast about El Camino de Santiago, or the Way of St. James, a pilgrimage. And pilgrims have walked the Camino for hundreds of years. Indeed, there are theories the Camino Francés, the most popular route between St. Jean-Pied-de-Port in France and Galicia in Spain, has been a path of trade for thousands of years. Pilgrims since the 8th century have walked to the majestic cathedral in Santiago de Compostela, which translates as St. James under a field of stars. We're told the remains of Christ's apostle St. James are interred beneath the cathedral, and it has to be seen to be believed. Pilgrims arrive in the square outside the cathedral, singing, dancing, hugging, crying. Some have walked hundreds of kilometres, some thousands of kilometres. Almost every one of them will tell you a story of transformation. They'll say this is a moment of celebration, of clarity, of finding yourself. Now, if that sounds ridiculous, so be it. But I urge you to listen to the almost 170 interviews here on my podcast. There are stories of love, of life, forgiveness, reinvention, hope, overcoming extraordinary sadness, discovery, enlightenment, writing, singing, praying, and love. I keep returning to the American Pilgrims on the Camino gathering at Lake Tahoe in March. I was standing in the snow with a smile a mile wide. You don't get much snow in Sydney, Australia. A man walked past and patted me on the back and said, "We're the Commonwealth contingent." I wondered what he meant. He was Canadian. His name is Tom Friesen, and he has a great Camino story to tell. And yes, we were the Commonwealth contingent. I love Canadians, and Canadians love Australians, because we like to think of ourselves as humble, generous, and welcoming. But there's more to the story. Tom and I are both singers. There's an old Swedish proverb, those who wish to sing always find a song. Tom Friesen is on the line from London, Ontario. Welcome, Pilgrim.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Before we start, what's life like in London, Ontario?
Very quiet right now. My life is mostly virtual. I've been using technology to connect with friends around the world, so I haven't felt disconnected at all. I've been having meetings with people over various, for family. I've got a book club meeting coming up soon, but most of my meetings actually have been with communal friends. Like yesterday morning, I had a Good Friday service with some about 25 hospitaleros from mostly Spain, but some from Italy, one from France, a couple from Brazil, and Italy as well. So there was a lot of joy in seeing these familiar and sympathetic faces.
Yeah, you do a lot of training for hospitaleros and hospitaleras. You say, always speak to an experienced pilgrim before you go on the Camino. You will probably learn nothing new, but you're giving us free therapy.
So what? That's my attempt at a joke.
Go on, explain. Explain.
Well, I think it's really interesting because one of the things I should say I do is I helped coordinate a local chapter here in Canada with the Canadian Company of Pilgrims. We're a large country and it's difficult to get together on a unified basis. So we basically have local chapters spread across the country, and people will drive a couple of hours or more to get together with their communal friends and fellow pilgrims. But when we have our meetings, I always try and put in the meeting something that everybody will appreciate, and then we call a break so we can give people a chance to connect and exchange phone numbers and emails for that purpose of sharing with an experienced pilgrim. And then we have a group that starts off and does question and answer for people who haven't walked. But I also think it's very, very important that we debrief our Camino, that we unpack our Camino and give people a chance to share, because very often when they return back, they start trying to talk about this tremendously significant experience to their friends and family. And what happens is after about 5 minutes, the person they're looking and talking to kind of expresses some puzzlement and says, "So you stayed in places where there were beds for 40 and you walked for 25 kilometers and you were in all kinds of weather and there might have been bed bugs and there might have been, you weren't necessarily sure where you're going to stay." And they just kind of draw a blank at that kind of experience. So it's wonderful for people who have walked the Camino to get a chance to share with someone who's actually interested in the experience that they've had, because many of us have found it to be a watershed moment in their lives, life-changing experience.
Yeah, you know, when you and I emailed back and forth, you talked about being the rock in the stream. What did you mean?
Well, the hospitalero is the person who makes it possible for the Camino to be such a accessible place for pilgrims. There's a lot of shelters that are open. Most of them are actually private businesses, and it's an opportunity for Spanish people or Portuguese or French or Italians to make some money from the pilgrim traffic. And I recognize that to some degree it's a business, but it's not a business where they're really gouging people. They're supporting the pilgrims as they walk along.
Sure.
I work for a service called Hospitaleros Voluntarios, and that means voluntary pilgrim shelter workers. The English like to call them wardens. That has a bit of a different connotation in our country. So you won't find me talking about wardens very often. But the opportunity to be in one place and watch the pilgrim groups come through. And it's fascinating for me because every night there's a different culture, if you will, or a different ambiance in the albergue as the pilgrims arrive, sometimes as a well-integrated team. Sometimes they've been walking together for quite a while, depending on where you meet them along the way or when they started, of course. But there's often the social director, the tour guide, the medic, the translator, the singer, the cook. They have all these different, sometimes it's the same person with multiple roles, but they come in and across languages, across cultures, across religions, they bond and they form this tightly connected group of people. And when some of the places you'll see when somebody's time is up to be on the Camino, in Europe it's more often that they walk sections of the Camino rather than the whole thing, as people from Australia and Canada will do. But we see them with actual tears in their eyes as they say goodbye to the people that are in their Camino family or their Camino team, or one of my friends called them the Camino pod. And that's interesting for me to watch that.
Yeah, yeah. How did the Camino come into your life?
I was at a watershed moment in my life. I had retired and I was looking around for things to do that would get me physically active. And I was also interested in travel. I'd never been to Europe before and I wanted to have a different experience. And I found out about a program in Spain where I could go and speak English to Spanish people who had taken English lessons and learn about the culture and stay for a week in a place at no charge to me, which I thought was appealing. And then I thought, well, I'll couple that with a walk across Spain on the Camino de Santiago. I've been a hiker for a while. So it wasn't, and I was going, and my Camino actually, the first one was from February 22nd to March 21st, to from Roncesvalles across to Santiago. Got to Roncesvalles and had waist-deep snow, but I was dressed as a Canadian boy in the snow. I had my Gore-Tex outerwear and my layers and my heavy boots and my gaiters and my poles, and I was ready to go. The only other people who were in Roncesvalles when I arrived there were two other women from Mallorca, and they had not planned to connect at all. But when they saw that they had a Canadian who knew how to see the trail in the snow, which they did not, and also I was carrying a toilet paper, which was in short supply in the albergue, they figured that I might be useful along the way, and it tremendously enriched my Camino because it gave me a connection and an inner life and inner workings of the Spanish life behind the scenes. One of the women spoke very good English. The other one spoke hardly none at all. We agreed we were going to try speaking in Spanish. It frustrated the English speaking Majorcan quite a bit. She once said to me, "Oh, Tomas, tu español me duele la cabeza. Your Spanish gives me a headache." Yeah. I've kept in touch with those women. One of them has visited Canada with her partner, and the other one I go walking with on a regular basis. We normally walk in November when she gets laid off from her job at the airport due to tourist numbers dropping. But we've kept in touch, and to me, they're Camino sisters. And walking with them, I think I changed from being a tourist and a cultural traveler to calling myself a pilgrim, feeling that there was a connection with these people, feeling like that Spain had something for me, admiring the hospitality, admiring the connection with the people had with the pilgrims. I had signed up for a hospital training before I went because there was a meeting in Toronto between the American Pilgrims gathering that we both experienced this recently, and the Canadian Company of Pilgrims. So they're having an international conference, and they always put a hospital training at the beginning of it. So I had signed up for that. So I was actually looking fairly carefully at the hospitaleros that I was seeing along the way to see which model I would be picking up on and which models I would be throwing off to the side.
Yeah, because you've served in Spain for half a month yearly since 2006. What have you seen and what change have you seen in those 15 years, Tom?
Well, the change has been quite significant, mostly along the lines of technology and numbers of pilgrims. When I was walking, of course, it was quieter time. It was actually a winter Camino. So I could count on two hands all the pilgrims that I met between Roncesvalles and Santiago. And I knew everybody's name and we were checking in who would come into Santiago. Also, people did not walk with their cell phones glued to their ear, and there wasn't the need to find connections so people could recharge their cell phones.
Yeah, right.
Everybody's walking with a paper guide of different descriptions, and it was a bit quieter time when I went. It's become more busy, of course, but you can also find those quiet times if you get off the main route. There's lots of. It's really more correct to say the Caminos, because there's many, many routes to Santiago.
Yeah.
And there's routes that lead away from Santiago, but you can get on those routes. And I walked with my friend Rosa, and we've had times when we saw almost no one for close to a week. So
yeah. So
it's still there.
Yeah. 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 So you mentioned earlier the Mallorcans and walking as a pilgrim, as opposed to a tourist, but it's often said that pilgrims aren't tourists. And I'm sure at times demanding pilgrims. What advice would you give to pilgrims from a hospitalero's perspective?
Well, in my perspective as a hospitalero, that the albergue becomes my home for half a month, and I try and treat people arriving with the hospitality I would show them if they were coming into my home.
Mm.
So there's music playing in the background, possibly there's flowers on the table, there's probably the offer of water, coffee, or tea. I try not to get into the formalities. I have to register pilgrims, and I have to record their identification information,
sure,
both for the safety of the albergue and the other pilgrims. But I don't do that right away. I introduce myself. I say, welcome. Would you like some coffee, tea, some water? And we try and create a relationship. And I'll introduce pilgrims to other pilgrims if they don't know each other. So there's a kind of a hospitality ethic that I'm trying to promote. And for me, watching that moment when the walker, the adventurer, the hiker, the cultural tourist, the cyclist becomes a pilgrim is a beautiful moment. And I can see it happening in front of me as they are much more aware of the people at their sides.
Yeah, how fantastic. But let me ask you a very simple question. Given its challenges, and I'm sure there are many, why do you volunteer as a hospitalero?
I think for that reason of watching the transformation of these various characters who arrive at the albergue becoming pilgrims. There's also lots of other advantages. When you are staying in one place for a while, you get a chance to get into the rhythm of the town and actually be accepted as a member of the town. Or the city where you're at, in the local area. I always advise the hospitaleros to go to a place, and we're not supposed to give recommendations about places we're eating or we're getting our Wi-Fi, etc. But if you go back to the same place a few times, the Spanish warm up remarkably. I'll just tell you a quick story. In Zamora, which is on the Villa de la Plata, I was there in 2010 with a friend from London, and we went into the churrería, which was across from the market, every morning, and had some breakfast there. There were two churrerias, and he actually liked the other one because it was more spread out. So we take turns going back and forth, which is what we're supposed to do anyway. But they found out that we were from Canada. We were wearing panuelos. We have this neckerchief that we were. People ask us sometimes if we're scouts, although people in Spain will recognize that people from different areas actually wear a neckerchief as an identifier, sometimes with colors or with something written on it. But we were wearing that, so they knew we were from Canada. And the next year I went back, and I was actually working in Salamanca, but the train stopped in Zamora, and it stopped early in the morning. So they kind of saved my life at 6 o'clock in the morning when they opened up, and it was a cool night. And they came in, and they said, hey, we know you. I said, yes. They said, you're a pilgrim from Canada. I said, well, actually, I'm a hospitalero from Canada, but you're right. I was here last year, and you know, we remembered and recorded that. Well, the following year, I was back to Zamora just by the luck of the draw, and I walked into the albergue, and they said, into the churrería, the churros place, and they said, we know you. I said, yes. They said, you're a hospitalero. I said, yes, from Australia. I said, well, close. Kasi, kasi. The following year, I was back to Salamanca again, and I popped up to Zamora, and I walked in again, and they said, oh, we've got a question for you. Do kangaroos live in Canada?
That's a great story. You know, you just mentioned there, talking to the Spanish, you must speak very good Spanish, do you?
I speak functional Spanish. In a large group, I can get lost. I probably know what they're talking about, but I can get lost in some of the specifics.
Right.
When I'd taken some Spanish lessons and I could speak some very basic sentences, but the women I walked with became sisters to me. And so I really wanted, and they were going through certain struggles in their lives, and I wanted to speak to them on a deeper level. So I came back to Canada, and fortunately in London where I live, about 10% of the population is Latin American due to refugee resettlement and right. The fact that they found London a very copacetic place to set up. So we've got a lot of Latin Americans here, and I've got some friends who are from Latin America. And I went to the libraries, and I asked the librarian, Ken, you set me up with somebody who wants to learn English, I'll teach them Spanish. So very fortunately, I met a mother and a daughter from Colombia, and we exchanged languages for an hour a week for a couple of years, and that helped an awful lot.
Oh, what a great idea. That's a fantastic idea. I mentioned earlier that we met at the American Pilgrims on the Camino gathering at Lake Tahoe, and you sang songs in a breakout session in one of the evenings there. You sang a song that you often sing for pilgrims to wake them up from their slumber, Morning Has Broken. Yeah. And I said that my friend had stayed in the albergue and told me how beautiful it was to be woken by your singing. I think it might have been Framista. Did we work out Framista?
I've never worked in Framista.
No,
it's
no.
Where was it?
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But that's a lovely thing to be able to contribute to people's pilgrimage. So tell us, Tom, about music in your life. How did music and why does music play such a significant role in your life?
I think there was some music in my home when I was growing up, but mostly my father would come home after working Saturday morning on a sixth day of work of the week and lay on the couch and put on the Metropolitan Opera and go to sleep. Oh. If you turned it off, you'd wake up. But I think music came in most primarily when I had three children. And we had a 2.5-hour drive down to see my parents on a pretty regular basis and another hour to see my mother-in-law the other direction. And if we sang in the car, it kept fighting down quite a bit. So, and Canada has a very strong tradition of children's music. So we did a lot of that. And I've got grandchildren now, and I sing to them all the time. And it catches their attention. You know, music is the first thing that people respond to. And people who are at the end of their lives, who are kind of losing the sense of who they are, they'll respond to that as well. So music has this, to me, music is just joy in action. And I couldn't walk the Camino without singing. After Rosa and Guille left in Ponferrada the first year to go back home because their 3 weeks of holidays were over and they know I had to go back to work in Mallorca. There was a couple of days there where I found it hard to sing, but then I was back at it a couple of days later. I met them, by the way, a year and a day later at the same bus station, and we carried on out to the ocean in order to fulfill the communal promise to arrive as pilgrims together, both in Santiago and in Finisterre.
Fantastic.
But we sang, and the one woman presented as she was a businesswoman. She had a store at the beach, and she presented as fairly hard-headed. And I started singing, and I got her. She was the one who didn't speak any English, but I got her to repeat, sing a song. And so she would sing after that. And the second year when she came back to the Camino, she said to me in Spanish, which I now understood a bit better, you've changed me. And I think the joy that I was feeling was transferable. And I love singing to the pilgrims and waking them up that way. And the song choices are based somewhat on their nationalities.
Yeah, right. Well that's another interesting aspect of your passion for music, because you're a great student of music in terms of the Camino. Aren't you? And there's some great stories and lessons to learn.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite stories. I'm really also interested in why people want to walk the Camino, their motivations. And, you know, there's lots of reasons why you walk the Camino. Penance, gratitude, finding a new direction, grief for a loss, retirement changes, renewal of the body and spirit, tourism, culture, and language expansions. Those are all motives. But and I actually met some pilgrims who once said to me, "We are eating the Camino." They were doing a gastronomical excursion across the Camino, right, really enjoying the food. But my motive, as I said, is to try and create that transformation. But one of these motives was really made clear to me when I was working in Grañón, which is a parochial albergue, in May of 2012. And a pilgrim from France arrived, and we oriented him to the albergue and what was going to happen. And we told him there was a 7 o'clock mass. And he said, "I would like to sing Ave Maria at the mass, at the service." And I said, "Well, we're going to have to ask the priest." So Jesus Garcia, he's passed away now, but he was a loved pastor in Grañón. He arrived in the albergue very often, and he came that day, and I said, "Jesus, Jean-Marc would like to sing Ave Maria at the mass." And Jesus looked a bit tad skeptical to have his service altered for somebody. But I said, "Well, Jean-Marc, show us." Well, Jean-Marc was a teacher of voice and an opera singer, so he got the job very quickly as soon as he opened his voice. And so Jesus said, "I will call on you at the close of the mass," which he did. After the there's a benediction that they give in Grañón, the same one as Roncesvalles and some other places. Lovely piece of blessing to people. But after that, he called on Jean-Marc, and Jean-Marc sang Ave Maria. And then I'd also like to try and put singing into the dinner. So after the dinner hour, we were singing around. He sang something which was well appreciated by people, with a very wonderful voice that came out of him. But then in the service that we have in the choir loft in Grañón, where we pass a candle and people are invited to either pray or say a poem or just hold it in silence or sing, he sang again. And then it was time for people to go back to their beds and slip down. And he was lingering. So I said, "Jean-Marc, if you'd like to sing, this choir loft is designed to carry the voice across the church and it won't bother the pilgrims as they settle into their mattresses. Why don't you sing a couple songs?" So he did. And then at the close of that, he turned to me and he said, "When I was singing Ave Maria, that was for my daughter Marie. She died recently."
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. What a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Goodness. That's fantastic.
And those moments with pilgrims, and, you know, it could be even just helping clearing them of bed bugs, or it could be attending to an injury, or even giving them, sometimes they'll take tiny dollar store bottles of Vaseline and giving them the tips on how to prevent the blisters. Those opportunities to connect with them are magic. And, you know, you're the rock in the stream, but that rock has a shine to it.
Yeah. Lovely. Lovely way of describing it too, Tom. Yeah, I love that. So you emailed me saying that you'd like to talk about preparing pilgrims to undertake the hero's journey. The hero's journey. What does that mean? Tell us about that.
Well, I think the first name is Joseph Campbell, is somebody who talks about the idea of the Odyssey in literature. One of our classic themes that we have in literature and in cultural, and I think most cultures have it. You know, people go on walkabout or on spirit quest, and it's leaving home, going to some place with a destination and often with a spiritual purpose, and then returning home possibly with changes, possibly with some new learning, some new transformations that you've got. And I think that opportunity exists on the Camino. That's not the only place it exists, but it exists brilliantly on the Camino for people. And I think that spirit sort of unites us. And it's interesting to me that people before the Camino, they don't often identify themselves as pilgrims, but people who've been on the Camino have no trouble saying, "I'm a pilgrim." And to me, a pilgrim is a person who leaves home to find themselves.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true. And of course, the pilgrimage is a great metaphor for life. And taking that one step further, Tom, I wonder if you've given any thought to how we can spread our pilgrim spirit in our own communities.
Well, we have a number of activities that we run in London. Each of our local chapters in Canada is quite unique and based on the resources that they have and places to meet and the interests of the group. In London, we've been very fortunate that we were started by a couple of artists. So we've often had either presentations of art or art gallery openings.
Sure.
We've also done in our meetings, we have a welcome back for experienced pilgrims. And then we ask the experienced pilgrims to read a poem, which starts off, "As you begin this pilgrim journey, may your heart be open to surprise." And then it goes on from there. But they're sort of passing the torch to the new pilgrims. And we're identifying some of the values and some of the learnings that people have as they get on the Camino. We also have things like a labyrinth walk. And we organize a labyrinth walk, and we talk about the labyrinth as an analogy for a Camino. And we in times when we can meet together, that's not right now, but in times when we can meet together, we talk about how you can see people on the labyrinth. And one moment they're ahead of you, and then they're beside you, and then they're coming the other way, and then they're behind you. And you encounter people in your lives that way. And you encounter situations and challenges in the very same way. So those are some of the ways that we try and put a sense of spirituality into the Camino. And of course, the singing, I think, to me, singing is just a way that we lift our hearts and our spirits and get past ourselves. I know not everybody likes to sing, and some of the Spanish, there's an expression in Spanish, if I sing, it will rain. often people will give themselves that excuse as you don't want me singing. And I walk with an Italian retired engineer and a Spanish retired banker, and when we linked up in Arez on the Camino Aragonés, and I said, "Oh, Giorgio, you're Italian. You must like to sing." Well, sure he did, and he would sing, and then I would sing, and then I would say, "Jose Luis, it's your turn," and he went, "No canto, I don't sing." But when we were walking and we were not close to him, we could hear him sing. Ah. he kind of caught the bug.
Yeah,
he wasn't going to sing in front of us, but he had that sense of singing. How can I keep from singing?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes you find yourself alone and you think, "Oh, you don't even realize you're singing." It's just subconscious almost, isn't it? And then someone will walk up to you and say, "Oh, I enjoyed you." "Oh, you didn't even realize I was singing." Tom, do you have a favorite Camino song?
Well, I'm actually known in Spain for Alleluia, and I've used that in a couple of different ways. I've been invited to sing that at when the Hospitaleros, they always have a gathering for summing up of the year, and it's between around the time of December the 6th to the 8th, because there's two Spanish holidays, the Constitution Day and the Day of the Immaculate Conception. There are those, and that's what they call el puente, the bridge between. In Spanish people, when there's two holidays 2 days apart, that means that the day in the middle is automatically a holiday too. So hospitals get together on those days, and we have a mass for them in Immaculata, and they say, "Tom, will you sing Hallelujah?" Now, I recognize that Hallelujah is a tremendously spiritual song, but to be honest with you, the Spanish people don't care. They actually invited me to sing that a couple of days ago for the Good Friday service. But in the pilgrim shelters, after dinner, whenever possible, I will say to people, we have a saying in English, "Sing for your supper."
Yeah.
In Spanish, that's cantad para cenar. And I'll say, "So we're going to sing together, and I want you to sing with me." And I'll start off by singing the chorus to Hallelujah, and they all know it. Much to my surprise, in 2005, when I first walked, Spanish people all knew that song. It was because it was on the soundtrack for Shrek, which had just come out the year before.
Right.
Rufus Wainwright's edition was on that. So everybody knew Hallelujah. And so I would sing the song I would start with the chorus, I would sing two lines, and then I would stick the chorus in, and I would gesture with my hands, "Come out and sing it, help me with it." And 90% of the people would jump in and at least try a little bit, because it's a universal word across languages. And then I would say to them quite proudly, "That's a song from my country, from Canada. You have a song from your country." And then we would go around the table and we would get people to contribute the songs from their own countries. And it could have been their national anthem, or it could be a folk song or a children's song. The interesting thing for me, in the year I was doing that in May 2012, back in Grañón, was that the best singers that year for me were the Koreans. And watching the other pilgrims' eyes open wide when they watch these Koreans open their mouths and sing was a wonderful feeling of satisfaction, because they've been walking beside them, and Koreans tend to be fairly humble and quiet. But when they were singing, suddenly there was a whole revelation for the other pilgrims.
Yeah, that's right. They are very humble and quiet. and very respectful and lovely to walk with and spend time with. What songs did they sing mainly?
Well, there's children's songs. One of the things that it aids them a lot is that in Korea, my daughter worked in Korea for a couple of years, and I went over to visit her. They actually have like karaoke rooms, but they're rooms. They're not for the general public. You come in with your family and your friends, and you bring your snacks and your drinks, and then you load up the karaoke machine and you play the songs you wish to. And they're often know some lots of English songs, but they're also great Korean songs that have kind of a different tonal melody, but they're no less beautiful. The last Korean that I remember singing was this past year in Nakara, and he was yodeling, which isn't Korean. It was just he had loved the thing yodeling, but he was actually very good at it.
a Korean yodeler. Now, that's not something you hear every day. Yep. That's fantastic. Yep.
No, you don't hear that every day.
you've met a lot of people, and you said earlier that you've seen a lot of transformation, and it's part of the enjoyment for you is watching that transformation in people. Let me ask you this. Is the Camino for everyone?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I don't think it is, and I think that's part of the issue. I think you have to step off into the unknown a bit to do the Camino, and I think that sort of teases people out a little bit. I know there are people who go on the Camino who aren't necessarily prepared. I remember in one of the albergues, there was a great big Texan with a huge pack, and he sat down with a lot of weight to his relaxation pose, and he said, "I saw that movie The Way before I came. I really liked it. I don't like it so much anymore. It didn't show the mountains." From your theater seat, it's kind of hard to feel the mountains, even if it did show the mountains. But I think, you know, there are people certainly who arrive as somewhat entitled. And the hospitals have an expression, the tourist demands, the pilgrim accepts with gratitude. And I always think that I'm there to serve the pilgrims. And I'm going to try to remember those wonderful pilgrims, because there's lots of wonderful pilgrims. The other advantage, of course, too, is the Hospitalero service. We stop in and visit each other and see each other and support each other. So there's great sense. One of the things they give you when you go to serve, we make sure from Canada that we send people, besides the panuela, which they're wearing to identify themselves as a Canadian, we also send them a muñequito, which is a little yellow man. I'm holding it up so you can see.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But that's a symbol of the Hospitalero service. And when you're wearing that, the hospitals know that you're one of them, and it's like you're a brother or a sister. So you can actually, they would store a bag for you, for example. Or I walked into Erez and they said, "Oh, you're a hospitalero. Would you like to cut the bread? And can you make the salad? Do you have a prayer for the dinner?" So I got drafted just for the night, and I was happy to do it.
Yeah, I bet you were. I bet you were. Let me go one step further. If there's somebody listening to this discussion and they really want to do the Camino and their family and friends say they're crazy, what would you say? What would you say to them?
Well, I always call the Camino mi obsesión magnífica. It's a magnificent obsession that I think gives people an opportunity to really look at their lives and we often look at it as a before and after experience, and to find, to simplify, to prioritize, to value, to celebrate. There's all these things that come out of doing a Camino. I think the Camino for me made me more tolerant. I don't judge other people's Caminos. Yeah. People have neither their backpacks transported. I don't know what's in their backpack. I don't know what's in their body, what struggles they're facing. If somebody wants to stay in hotels rather than pilgrim shelters, that's fine. That's their Camino, and I'm happy to see them have an experience, because it's individual for everyone. And people, I think, get different things out of it based on what you put into it. But certainly that stepping off into the unknown and getting a chance to experience Spanish hospitality and the beautiful countryside and the monuments and the historical events and the fact that almost every town has its own saint or its own miracle or its own festival around something. It's just a miracle of hospitality.
Yeah. And you conduct classes and talks, and one of the subjects is unpacking the Camino for pilgrims who return. What's your advice to make it easier to come home and survive and make sense of it all post Camino?
I think you can find people to share the experience with. That's really helpful. I think you can also share the experience by reading books. I have some favorite books that I read that take me back there. And I think, oh yeah, this person really got what I got out of it. I read other books where people, I'm thinking, well, that was a different experience Camino than the one I had, but I'm just as glad for what I got out of it.
Yeah.
There's also, you know, these podcasts, there's, you know, there's blogs, there's YouTube videos. Spain has a very interesting history and culture. It's quite tortured, of course, but it's really interesting and it's worth exploring and getting into. So there's all of that that can keep the Camino alive. This opportunity to use technology to meet across distances is working brilliantly for me. It just came along at the right time. If it would come along 5 years ago when we weren't as smooth about getting people to be able to communicate from, you know, Canada to Australia, across to England. I was communicating this morning with some people talking about the fact we canceled an hospitalero training and how to keep the Camino alive, how to work on their Spanish, how to learn about Spain. And it was for people who had signed up for a couple of courses that we had offered and canceled. But one of the person invited her partner who lives in Britain, which is right across on the other side. And the technology worked brilliantly. It's where he was next door.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, isn't it? And to see all of these people singing songs together, choirs singing songs together. Yeah. It's just absolutely fantastic.
And it really is.
I think, you know, someone said to me very early on from my yoga studio, they said, in crisis creates opportunity, and we're going to see great change. Yep. That's certainly the case, and I think it's wonderful. It really is. Give us one way, Tom, that your Camino life resonates with you in your day-to-day life.
Well, I think when you come back as a pilgrim, you've been given a gift, and you recognize how lucky you are, and there's opportunities to give that gift to others, not just the Camino I'm talking about. I'm really proud of our local pilgrim group because we, for example, prepare meals at a church. We have a prep team that prepares a stew the second Friday of the month. And then every 6 weeks, we come together as a group of about 20 to 25 people.
Yeah.
And we're serving close to 200 meals to the needy of the community. And giving to people and recognizing them and telling them honestly, as you look them in the eye, that we're glad you're here. To me, that is an extension of the hospitality that the Camino has given me.
Yeah, that's great. You wrote to me to say your feeling is that pilgrims walk in Spain without really getting to understand the country that is hosting them. And,
yes.
And you wanted to raise as part of the interview Spanish customs and culture. I think that's very, true. Very important. I've said often here on this podcast, I love the slow tourism of walking through Spain.
Yes.
When you really can be engulfed by the culture. It would be a terrible shame not to appreciate that.
Well, it's not the pilgrim's fault. The schedule that the pilgrims follow doesn't really line up very well with the Spanish schedule. These pilgrims are getting up early in the morning and they're getting out of town often as the sun is rising, and the Spanish have a little later habit to rise. The Spanish have the longest day, I think, in Europe in terms of a working day because of the siesta stuck in the middle. And then they're very welcome. They're very open to actually going out and partying at night. I'm often astonished at the stamina that my Spanish friends have to go have meetings all day and then to go and party into the wee hours and to get up the next morning and be ready to go again. It's just incredible. So one of my friends described it to me. They said, for Spanish people, drinking is not a sprint. It's a marathon.
Yeah.
I remember being in Spain and staying in a touristy area and thinking, oh, it's 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. It's not too noisy out there. I'll wait till 4 or 5 in the morning.
Yeah, I know.
But other customs that I love about the Spanish people are very active in the morning, and they have lots of markets and they have opportunities to get together. One of the things you'll notice at a market often is the Spanish people don't go to the stall that's empty because you can get your stuff and escape like we Anglos do. They find the stall that's the busiest. They go ask who the last person was. El Último, and then they know they follow that person, and they sit and chat and gossip and exchange news together because they love to be social together. I don't know what this coronavirus is going to do there, because they can't keep their hands off each other. When you meet a Spanish person, the normal thing to do is to give them a hug if it's a man, and to double tap the cheeks with an air kiss, or if it's a real good friend, you actually kiss them on the cheek. And I can see that sadly changing, and I don't like to see that happening. When you walk into a restaurant, people are eating. You stop at their table and you say to them, "Buen provecho, que aprovecho, buen provecho." If they're Catalans from the Barcelona area, Tarragona, you would say "Bon profit." And what you're doing is you're wishing them a happy meal. I like to try and joke that the translation for that in English is "Bon appetit." Because yeah. I don't think the Anglos take this. And Spanish people look at us in a bit of surprise that we see meals as something to dash the food down and then go on to the next, because they linger over it, they celebrate over it, they look each other in the eye. When I'm toasting with my Spanish friends, I will say "salud," which means "to your health." But if I don't look them in the eye, they won't tap the glass. You have to look them in the eye to tap the glass. And there's that sense of hospitality. And then as the evening, because Spain has a lot of heat through the summer, especially, and which makes the siesta very, very practical and a safety measure, you'll find them indoors having meals. Then their biggest meal of the day is their lunchtime meal, their comida. And they will do that in their homes or in restaurants and bars. And they're there for a significant amount of time. You know, and a Spanish waiter, you have to ask him for the check. He's not going to bring it over automatically. That's quite rude on his part. So you have to scribble in your hand with your finger, or you have to say "la cuenta" and ask him for that. So there's all the, and then at night they'll drive to the downtown and they'll take out their buggies and have their children dressed in all their finery and walk around and enjoy meeting and greeting and telling each other how beautiful their children are. It's a charming, charming culture.
Yeah, and you're right when you say it really will impact them, this whole coronavirus thing, because it's contrary to everything that they love and cherish. Let's talk about your Camino, Tom. I've got a handful of quick questions here for you. A favorite place?
Well, there's many. In terms of a stage of the Camino, I love the walk over the Cross of Iron from Fuenlabrada up in the hills, down into El Acebo and even down into Molina Seca, entering the Bierzo Valley.
Yeah, yeah. I love that part of the world too. How many Compostelas do you have?
Well, you know, I don't always go get them. I think I've got 3 or 4 I could put my hands on. To me, they're less important than the actual opportunity to be among the pilgrims.
Is there a Camino shrine in Casa Tom?
Yes, there is.
Is there? Tell us about it.
We moved into an apartment, and the apartment has some very odd angles. And one of the rooms, the den of the apartment, has a very sharp corner. Comes in at probably like maybe a 70-degree angle. And so what I did was I built some bookshelves there, and I have a couple of layers of Camino books. My friends Rose and Guille gave me some botas de madera, some wooden boots from the Galicia. They sit at the bottom. My hospitalero scarves often is sitting on it. By the way, and part of the hospital scarf is your Australian hospitalero.
Ah, there you are.
I helped them with their first training. We wrote the manual for doing it, and they were training people around the world. And then there's pictures of my friends and some shells and various things. But yeah, that's a place where I'm quite happy to go and look and pull out a book. And
fantastic. What did you do for a living before you retired?
I was a teacher of the deaf.
Ah.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about my love of music. I taught mostly in the high school, and I taught a lot of different subjects because it was a small school and we had to be generous. But for 4 years, I taught grade 2 and 3, and I talked the principal into allowing me to have one period of half an hour of music every 6 days. So different days of the week, I'd be trucking my guitar into the school, and we played, you know, things like the Johnny Appleseed song, "The Lord Is Good to Me," and songs by some of the performers that I loved singing my children to. And people would occasionally meet me in the hall, and they would say, "Tom, we didn't know you played the guitar." and I would hold myself very erect, and I would say, I play the guitar and I sing for deaf people. But the kids enjoyed that tremendously. But anyway, it was a wonderful career. We had a great staff, and the kids were from basically a largely rural, small town, small city area. So they were lovely, lovely people, and we had high expectations for them, and many times they came up to that and beyond.
So I think it's probably an obvious question. How does the guitar, how does a deaf child appreciate the guitar?
Well, deafness is not a total on or off thing. Most deaf people have some residual hearing. And especially in the time when I was doing this, hearing aids were encouraged, and we had FM systems where we could, we were mic'd as teachers. We had to remember to turn the mic off when we went to the washroom. And some of our children were partially hearing. They may have had other issues. The thing with deafness is it's not necessarily a total absence of sound. It's an absence of being able to discriminate sound clearly. And what I use for lay people is, if you think about when you're driving in your car and your radio is getting out of range of the station and it's getting a bit of distortion in it, if you turn the radio up louder, it doesn't necessarily make you understand any better. And for deaf people, some of the sounds that are in the normal range of hearing aren't available to them. Now, my wife is deaf and she's got a severe to profound hearing loss, but hearing aids have become so good that they're like little computers in your ear. And we swear that she can actually hear better than I can sometimes. I think that's true.
Wow, what a great story. You just mentioned your wife. What do your friends and family make of all of this Camino life?
Well, I had the joy of taking my brother and his son on the Camino. We walked the Camino Portuguese, walking up the coast in Portugal and across along the coast of Spain, and then in and up to Santiago a couple of years ago. And that was a joyous experience. In the main, my nephew has very long legs, and keeping up to him one is sometimes a bit of a challenge. But and we also, I won't forgive him because we were walking out of Vigo, and I said to him, "Sunday, Ben, you should look for chocolates con churro." And my friend Rosa, who was walking with us, said, "He's walking so fast, he's not going to stop. We're going to get out of town." We walked all morning without eating because he dragged us out of town before we could find a. There's lots of them that he passed by. He just blew right by them. But my brother, he's actually sent me a song just recently that has a Camino connection. So, often he will introduce me to people. He offers house concerts, and he often will introduce me to people who have an interest in the Camino, and we will chat about that. The others certainly recognized that I have a love for Spain, and when they're planning a trip there, they'll talk to me about which should I go and who should I do. And
yeah,
one of my other nieces worked in Spain as an au pair girl. She worked in Burgos, and she worked in San Ramón de la Calzada, and she worked in Grañón. So she got to see a fairly good sized city, very very small city or a large town, and a small town of 300 people. And she had a stellar experience. When I go back there, the people all say to me, "How's Stephanie doing?" they don't say nice to see you. They say, "How's Stephanie doing?"
Oh, that's so great. That's fantastic.
No, she became part of their family.
yeah. What advice would you give to somebody who's listening today and they're thinking of walking?
Well, it's your Camino, and you should organize it the way you want to. Weight is really important. We often think that we need to take care of everything. Spain is a modern country, and you can pick up things along the way if you need them. More often, the pilgrims will be dropping stuff, extra weight, off in the caja de donativos, the donation box that you'll find in every albergue, because they've taken too much. So I think what you do want to do is you want to get your backpack packed, go back to the store where you bought it, and ask them to help you with adjusting it so it works to your body. Realize that it's the day after day after day walking that can beat you up. So don't listen to your body carefully, and don't go past your pain threshold. If you've got hot spots in your feet, stop, take off your socks, put some Vaseline, or there's Foot Glide, there's other kinds of products that you can put on, and protect your feet so that you're walking well. If you're feeling a pain, then maybe it's time to stop. And you don't necessarily have to plan the Camino by every stop. There's also lots of great resources that you can get. These the podcasts are a great resource. The blogs, the Camino forum, and Camino guidebooks as well. There's a number of really great guidebooks. I was very fortunate my first year because there was a Canadian guidebook and it did a wonderful job of integrating the nature with the historical things that were happening. And so every morning as Rosa and Guille would do their stretches and put on their Vaseline, I'd be reading my guidebook. And then later on in the day when they'd be explaining something to me that happened in a place, I had actually already pre-read about that. So I looked a little better in Spanish than I actually was because I could relate to what they were talking about. But it's a total experience that I think is your experience, and you sort of keep it for yourself in terms of the way you want to do it. Also, don't get a schedule that forces you to hasten your trip. Give yourself a couple of rest days. If you stop in places like Pamplona or Burgos or Leon, you could actually see the Spanish nightlife. You're allowed to stay in the pilgrim shelters for one night unless you're injured or sick. Consider the second night maybe taking a pension or a hotel or a room which you can rent, and that way you can stay up a little later. You can sleep in the morning a bit, and you can also get out and experience the tapas culture or visit surrounding museums and the churches. There's a real wealth of culture there, and I think if you pre-prepare by doing some reading about Spanish life or Spanish culture and history, it pays you back many times.
Yeah, that's right. Look, you've been very kind with your time, Tom. Tell us a Camino story.
Well, I'll tell you how I met the woman who trained me as a hospitalero. The Spanish people were sending people over from Europe to train. And I had signed up for this training. And I walked in February, March, as I said to you. And my friends who I walked with were often not really flexible about taking detours. I would suggest some place to go. But one day we were coming down from the Alto de Perdón, that place with all those rusted statues of traditional pilgrims. And they said, let's go this way. And they went over to Eyunate. And Eyunate is a very interesting eight-sided small church. People think it might be connected with the Templars because of the eight-sidedness.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a half colonnade there. Anyway, we went in and we were listening to Gregorian chant, which they were playing inside the church. And so after a while, we got out and we went over, and that's not a church that's in a city or a town. It's out in the country by itself. So it's quite strange it's more than a chapel, but there's no civilians around there. Obanos is about 2 kilometers away. Anyway, we knocked on the door because the girls wanted to get a sello, a stamp for their passports or their pilgrim credentials. And they would get sales in museums and universities and art galleries and any albergues. Bars were turístico. They weren't getting sales in the bars, which you can do, but that wasn't their way they envisioned their Camino. Anyway, this short woman arrived at the door, and she threw open the door, and she said, oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to put the sale up for you. This was February, so it wouldn't be a time. There's a lot of pilgrims going by anyway. And she said, why don't you come in and have some tea with me? And she fed us chai tea, and her husband later said she must have liked you guys automatically because she doesn't give her chai tea to everybody. But as we were passing in the door of this very small albergue, which only has 7 mats on the floor upstairs, we weren't staying there for the night. We were just stopping for the stamp. But she said, come in. There was a poster on the wall, and the poster on the wall said, A Gathering of Pilgrims, Toronto, May 2005. And I pointed to it, and I said, I'm going to that. And she said, I'm going to that too. And because I had signed up for the hospitalero training and she was the hospitalera, I said, I'm going to take the hospitalero training. And she said, great, I'll be your teacher.
Oh, no way. That's great.
Yeah. And she came over and she played the guitar and she had a voice like an angel. And she was really inspirational in terms of the training she gave. And even more than that, it appeared that she was Venezuelan, had met her husband who was a Dutch civil engineer in Venezuela. They got married and they had some children back in Holland, and they walked from Holland. She actually, I visited them and she showed me where they had started from in Holland. So you talk about thousands of kilometers, that's thousands of kilometers to Santiago. And they had basically, I think, camped their way most of the way. This was back in the 90s. And they got so inspired by it that they came back to Amsterdam, sold what they owned, took the money and started fixing up albergues across Spain. And when they got them into good shape, they would move on. And at the time she said to us, Eyunate is our last albergue. And the only reason we got in here was because the parish priest was my parish priest back in Venezuela. But we don't have any more money left, and this is not something that we own. This is basically on loan to us. And if the community wants to take it back, they're going to get it back. Now, the other part of the story that I have to tell people is that when she came, she had been diagnosed with a uterine tumor. And the doctors would say, you better stay and get that operated on. And she said, no, I've got a commitment to walk to train these hospitaleros. So she came and gave us a marvelous training. It was fully dynamic, and you wouldn't have guessed there was anything wrong with her.
Yeah.
The next day, I drove her and some other friends to Niagara Falls to see Niagara Falls, and she kind of told me that she had this health crisis coming and that she was there was limited time. But she went to Niagara Falls. She was on the deck of the Rainbow Falls for half an hour in trance in that, and we went over to the Butterfly Museum, and Butterfly Conservatory, 45 minutes there, and then she was done. And I actually never saw her for the rest of the conference that was there, even though she was still there. She was kind of resting till she could go back. She did get operated on. It was benign. She's now living in Amsterdam as la abuela, the grandmother for her grandchildren.
Wow, what a great story. I'd love to find her, Tom.
Well, I can connect you, I think.
Let's work that out. One final question. We sang Amazing Grace together at Lake Tahoe.
Yes.
I was blind, but now I see. Would you be the same man you are today if the Camino had not come into your life?
Oh, absolutely not. I think the Camino opened my eyes to friendships and to culture and to hospitality in ways that have been deeply enriching. If you've got time for one more little quick story.
Of course.
I inveigled a young woman in Font de Vedon to read, to sing. I didn't normally ask people to come to the oración or the Vesper service in the little chapel that is in Font de Vedon, but she was singing in the albergue, and she came in with she spoke French to her father. She had a Portuguese passport. She was speaking Spanish to the other young people who were in the albergue that day. And I said, will you sing something? So during the service of Vespers, she sang Amazing Grace. And as she sang that line, she sang, was blind, but now I see, which is the pronunciation that a Spanish person would give to that word of blind. And then after that, she said, what's that song mean? She sang that song totally by rote without knowledge of the meaning. And it was my delight to be able to tell her about the slave captain who had Reformation and created the song as a recognition that his life had been transformed by the experience of faith.
Yeah, that's right. It's a great song. Well, look, Tom, I think you're fantastic. You have an energy. You really do. You have an energy about you. And I noticed in Tahoe that your aura, I remember writing a note on the bottom of my notepad when I got back to my hotel room, Tom, aura buzzing like a bee.
There's a Canadian author that wrote, he jumped on his horse and rode off madly in all directions. And I think he was talking about me when he wrote that line.
Well, underneath aura buzzing like a bee, I wrote spreading the Camino pollen, which I love. Yeah. Thanks for being you. Thanks very much for having the time or taking the time to share your story. And thanks for caring for all those hundreds, perhaps thousands of pilgrims. Your generosity of spirit makes you one in a million, my friend.
It gives more than I get.
Let's have a couple of pops on the Chesterfield.
Sure. if you get to Canada, please try and swing by. I would love to have you speak to our groups in Canada. The presentation that you made as the Camino and its community and family, and the pictures you saw, you had me. We just put the pictures. They were from your Italian photographer friend, but the presentation was well worth the time. I recognize that Lake Tahoe was a bit of a opportunity to do some broken field running, but I thought they handled that brilliantly, and you were a part of that. So I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. And I look forward to our paths crossing again soon. Buen Camino, my friend.
Buen Camino.
My guest this week, the Canadian pilgrim and hospitalero, Tom Friesen. There's an old Swedish proverb, those who wish to sing always find a song. Sing as loud as you can. Sing with someone you love. If you can't, walk. Sing. If you can't see hope, sing. If love and life and the Camino was part of your plan and it's now out the door, sing instead. Go for a walk today and sing. Until next week, I'm Dan Mullins. Buen Camino.
Somewhere